America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live today from New York City and from the mothership here, the Air America headquarters. It's Veterans Day, actually, traditionally yesterday, November 11th, which is also was also my 35th wedding anniversary. Hey, Louise, happy anniversary. Veterans Day, but I guess the official holiday is today. And so we salute our veterans, our men and women in uniform, who through all so many generations have created and protected and held together this nation in so many ways and are now under such terrible stress. In particular, under such terrible stress by things like the Bush administration, Republicans in Congress fighting so hard to cut benefits to veterans. The tragedy, the 25% of our homeless people, for example, on any given night, are veterans, compared to veterans only being somewhere between 8 and 11% of the population, depending on whose numbers you're looking at. Male vets, anyway. So, it's Veterans Day. We'll come back to that as we go on through the program. Also, I want to get into in some length, in some detail, what's going on internationally. What's going on with the dollar? Is it possible that last Wednesday, the 11th month, the 7th day, the 7th year, 1177, supposedly lucky numbers, was the beginning of the Great Depression of the 21st century? We'll talk about that in our second hour. Right now, John Berlow is with us. He's the fellow in economic policy with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's the director of the Center for Entrepreneurship. CEI.org is the website. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be on, Tom.
Great to have you with us, John. John, the fires in Southern California and elsewhere, frankly. I mean, we've been having fires all across the West. And the droughts now in the Southeast, and this is not limited to the United States. There's large chunks of particularly equatorial regions of northern Africa, southern Europe, parts of Asia, where fires and droughts are getting worse and worse. For some reason, you guys are out there saying that this is all the result of environmentalists. Enlighten me, please.
Well, we said that specifically about the California fire, and there were some regulations that probably made the impact worse for homeowners. There has been a problem that we've documented since the mid-90s where homeowners don't know if they can clear brush if, say, the California gnatcatcher or the kangaroo rat. These are real species there.
Endangered species.
Live there, and without getting, you know, a take permit from the federal government. I linked to an article I wrote, an American Thinker, that's also on the CEI.org website, that said brush management, where the city of San Diego on their website said brush management is not allowed in coastal sage scrub during the California gnatcatcher nesting season from March 1st through August 15th. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of...
These are birds, by the way. For people who are listening, gnatcatchers are birds. They're not gnats. We're not protecting bugs.
They're the gnat catchers, but right. there's also the kangaroo rat.
Yep.
So,
yep.
And they didn't. The wildlife, the fires were also devastating for wildlife as well. So, were some of these laws defeating their own purposes? I think was the question.
Well, and that's a legitimate one. And fire management services, forest management services, and fire suppression, which was a big deal in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. Has been under radical reconsideration since the 80s and 90s, and in many cases and in many places been scaled back, and forests have been allowed to burn, and you know, we're kind of going back to the natural system that was here before we came along, you know, that Native Americans used and was certainly here before they're occupying this continent, of fire being part of the natural cycle. I mean, there's a lot of plants that actually can't even reseed until there's fire, and there are a lot of environments that are appropriate for particular types of particular species that are post-fire environments. But, you know, what baffles me is that it seems that what you guys are trying to say, the message that you're trying to leave people with, is it's these do-gooder environmentalists and the Environmental Protection Act that's causing this, when, in fact, the University of Arizona's Laboratory of Tree Ring Research the University of California, San Diego, Scripps Institution of Oceanography, published, among others, I mean, these are the most recent, this is just last year, published a series of studies that have looked at what are the variables that are affecting wildfires in the West. And they note that there are four times as many major wildfires between 1986 and 2004 as there were from 1970 to 86, and a six-fold increase in the area of forests burned in the west of the United States. Now, from 70 to 86, they were, you know, that was even, it was even, there was even more likely to be a fire because there was more tinder at the time. So what's the question? Why, you know, why would this be? Well, it turns out the active wildfire season has increased by more than 2 months. And individual fires are burning longer, up from barely a week on average to more than five. This, I'm quoting from the study. Snowpacks in the mountains has melted earlier, between 1 week and one month earlier on average than 50 years ago. And snowmelt is responsible for 75% of the annual stream flow. And then, you know, to put it in the language that scientists like to put these kinds of things, they say a second-order polynomial fit to the regional temperature signal alone explains 66% of the variance in the annual incidence of these fires, with many more wildfires burning in hotter than in cooler years. In other words, global warming is clearly and identifiably responsible for 66% of this. The remaining 33%, they split up among bad forest management, the urban sprawl. On their scale, actually, you know, reading through this study, I don't see any reference to the Endangered Species Act.
Well,
so what kind of science are you guys using?
There are many factors as you said, but we're using the homeowners that I quoted from there was a bipartisan task force started by Gray Davis state legislators of both parties served on it, which I cite in the American Thinker article that's also on CEI.org that mentioned that some of the environmental laws were counterproductive. It was the Blue Ribbon Task Force on Fire in California, and we are pointing that out as an exacerbating factor, as well as
are you quoting the committee's first of all, this is not a scientific panel, of course, but nonetheless bipartisan. Very often you have the majority, the consensus report, and then you have minority reports where the crackpots on both sides, frankly, you know, get their words on the record. What part of that report are you quoting?
I was quoting from the consensus part. I don't think there was a minority report in there, but I know I was quoting from the consensus part. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, there's going to be disagreement about solutions. There was some people said 300 feet. Some people said an automatic variance for 100 feet around the home. You've got some state laws conflicting with federal laws, but that was a finding. Now, there's not going to be agreement about exactly what to do about it, but they did list that as a factor, Tom.
We're talking right now with John Berlau. He, am I pronouncing it right, John?
Berlau. Everybody mispronounced.
Berlau. I'm sorry. And you've been on the program several times. I'm very sorry. Berlau. And he's a fellow in economic policy with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. CEI.org is the website, and director of the Center for Entrepreneurship. John, I know, you know, CEI has some funding affiliations with some of the oil companies. Why avoid global warming in your conversation? Is it because of that, or do you genuinely think that this isn't a variable?
Global warming, it's not been. There's a question. It's more shown that global warming is a variable in things like sea level rising than wildfires. It's sort of more difficult to pin down. It wasn't nearly as hot in this wildfire season, for instance. It got up to barely 90, whereas the record has been up more than 100 for this time of year in, say, 1965 and 1929. And the question is still, I mean, if the world is warming and things could happen, I mean, there could also be, you know, benefits as well as in some of the cooler climates as well as risks. What do you do about it? Should you tell people? I mean, and things like, you know, people being careful where they live, also having good brush and forest management technique. And I agree with you on letting some natural fires burn would be the most effective as far as human life and health.
But if the wildfire season has extended by 2 months now over the last 50 years, and that's clearly the signature of global warming, why not call for doing something about that as well?
I think the studies, as my colleagues have documented, that if we go fully with the Kyoto Treaty, and I think...
Oh, we need to go way beyond that.
Way beyond that. It would reduce just 0.05 degrees that the temperature... the temperature in 50 years. I think, you know, there's more immediate things we can do as far as brush management. I think Pat Michaels has disputed and used to be who was at the University of Virginia and others have disputed the
I'm sure the links are over at your website, right?
CEI.org,
right. John Burlow, thank you, John, for being with
thank
us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Well, I'm still a tourist in Texas, just asking any bar. Oh, well, I screwed the country, they still think I'm a star. Hear neighbors trust their neighbors, that's why I tap their phones. It keeps their freedom ringing, and I feel less alone. Even though I love them, that's just where I'm at. Besides, rumor has it that one's a Democrat. Let's go to Mars. Forget about your cares, let's go to Mars.
Yeah, it was one of his proposals, wasn't it?
Bring a case of beer, let's go to Mars.
Kind of went up and went down really fast. Good old George. Good old George. Amazing. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, I think, you know, our last interview just kind of speaks for itself, and we'll just let it stand. I said what I have to say about it, I think. Interesting study from Zogby just out. And by the way, we're broadcasting live today, tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday from here in New York City. And then Friday from San Francisco, we'll be at K Green. And Saturday, I'll be doing a book signing up in Carmel. And Sunday, I'm flying home, finally, to see Louise. So I'm looking forward to that. Zogby, the new Zogby poll. This is absolutely fascinating. And I don't know. I mean, there's a strange thing in here that might cause many of us who are doing progressive talk radio to consider how we're programming. This is just fascinating. First of all, the Zogby poll went out and asked people, you know, how they identified themselves. Are you liberal? Are you conservative? Are you independent? And then looked at their media habits, their media consumption habits, and how they behaved and how they were thinking. Reds, conservatives, make up 37% of the nation. Isn't that odd? We used to call Reds commies, right? Reds make up 37% of the nation, while blues, liberals, can comprise 39%, and moderates, 24%. Now, here's where it gets interesting. The conservatives, this 37%, tend only to want to watch conservative media. They pretty much only listen to right-wing talk radio, and they pretty much only watch Fox News and Fox TV. If they're going to watch something other than politics, it's sports, it's auto racing, it's things like that. I mean, you know, they play to all those stereotypes. They tend not to watch the premium channels. They tend not much to go to movies, and when they do, they're action thrillers, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger kind of movies and that sort of thing. But they're less likely, frankly, to listen to progressive talk radio, which always baffled me. I remember back in the day, back, you know, years ago, before I've been doing this show now, it'll be 6 years in March. And before that, I frankly, just like I think many people who are interested in politics, I would listen to the right wing talk radio and to the conservatives and yell at the radio and whatnot. But I would listen to them. And I remember them always, particularly Limbaugh, always saying, oh, I've got all kinds of liberals listening to the show. And I thought, yeah, probably does. And when I started doing this show, I was amazed at how few conservatives called in. To this day, it continues to amaze me because we have a standing policy here on the Tom Hartman Program that conservative callers, or frankly, even liberals who want to disagree with me, anybody who wants to pick a fight with me, anybody who wants to disagree with me, goes to the front of the line. I think that that's some of the most interesting conversation that can be had is conversation that highlights the issues, that brings them into stark relief. And a reasoned disagreement does that, in my opinion. And, you know, apparently our listeners agree. The ratings on our show are doing very, very well. But you know, without getting into the whole bragging routine, nonetheless, it seems that it's less likely that conservatives would be listening. I suspect that there may be more conservatives listening to this show than to other progressive shows, in large part because I'm putting conservatives on the air every day. But in any case, I thought that was interesting. Liberals, on the other hand, while conservatives, according to this study, listen to very little liberal talk radio. If you can, you can hear the fire alarm going off in the background. We had a drill earlier this morning. Nonetheless, liberals are more likely to listen to conservative programming. Actually, anything. You know, the blues, their preference, many different types of programming. Now, could this be because liberals are more, you know, pretty solid in who they are and what they're all about? They understand their worldview. They know what's going on. And they're not afraid of other points of view. Whereas if somebody is really fundamentally afraid of other points of view, you know, don't confuse me with the facts, then they would avoid the facts. I suspect that that's the case, although, you know, that's a kind of a caricature, a cartoon. What was particularly interesting to me was the purples, the independents, the 24% of independents that Zogby and Lear Center studied. These folks don't listen to any kind of political talk radio. They're watching sports, they're watching their cartoons, they're watching the soaps, and they really don't pay attention to politics until 3 weeks before the election, if then. So one of the conclusions, actually, that they made was that this might be a good thing for example, people who have mainstream entertainer support, like Barack Obama being supported by Oprah, for example, that may not mean much at all in the primary. And, in fact, it appears not to be moving the needle at all for him in the primary. But in the general election, where independents are coming in and voting, it may actually help. And I suspect that this research is going to, you know, on the political side, cause politicians to be changing their tunes and their behaviors. But, you know, on the radio and on the media side, I think it's fascinating. It's just fascinating. And it gives us an insight into the workings of the brains of conservatives and liberals. So, some amazing news in the news today, but we'll also be taking your calls right after the break at 866-303-2270. Any topic you'd like. Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air.
Oh, we're all going to find our way here. Welcome back. Tom Hartman with you. Anti-war Iraq vets wanted to participate in the Veterans Day Parade in Long Beach, California. There was also a group of pro, you know, I'm reluctant to even call it war, pro-occupation. I mean, we had wars against, we had a war against the Taliban in Afghanistan. We knocked them out. We put Hamid Karzai, the Unocal oil executive or consultant in, who wanted to get the pipeline, the gas pipeline across Afghanistan, which they're now building, got him in, and we had a war against Saddam Hussein, and we took out his government, and we seized his country, and we killed him. And so we had two successful wars. We now have these two unsuccessful occupations. And so I'm just reluctant to even use the word war, and I know I keep doing it myself from time to time, and it's just, it's... We've got to start catching ourselves. We are not at war. We are not at war. I defy anybody, any conservative, to demonstrate to me that we are at war. We have three things going on. We have an occupation of Iraq. That is not a war. It's an occupation. It's not going well. We have an occupation of Afghanistan. That's not a war. It's not going well. And we've got a group of political, quasi-political religious nutcases around the world who, because of our behaviors, particularly over the last 5 or 6 years, have been growing in number rather than diminishing as they should have, because the world was ready, was horrified after 9/11, and the vast majority of Muslims after 9/11 were ready to denounce bin Laden and his merry band and say, hey, you know, these guys are crazies. Just like Christians all across the United States denounced Tim McVeigh when he blew up the Oklahoma City bomb building in the name of Jesus. So, we have these three things going. None of these are wars. I mean, the British dealt with the IRA, the Italians dealt with the Red Brigades, the Germans dealt with the Bader-Meinhof gang, the Spanish deal with the Basque separatists, ETA. In every case, yeah, they're terrorists. Do you have a war on terrorism? No. You have You have criminal action against criminals. I mean, you have law enforcement action against criminals. You don't declare a war on a tactic. What is Spain supposed to say? We're going to declare a war on bombings. Well, of course, it's already illegal. You don't do. Anyhow, but I digress. Anti-war Iraq vets, or anti-occupation Iraq vets, wanted to show up at the Veterans Day Parade in Long Beach, California, and carry their, you know, out of Iraq now type signs. And the pro-occupation of Iraq vets wanted to show up and carry their We Love George Bush, Stay in Iraq signs. I won't make sarcastic remarks. And the organizer, one of the organizers, Brandon Friedman, says that, one of the organizers, who is not quoted, says, quote, it says that the anti-war Iraq vets were banned, these are veterans, banned from participating in the Veterans Day Parade in Long Beach, California, quote, because we do not want groups of a political nature advocating the troops' withdrawal from Iraq. And then Brandon Friedman on his blog, it's over at the Daily Kos, notes that the organizers seem to have no problem with groups advocating staying in Iraq. Meanwhile, Kennedy and Max Cleland and Ted Kennedy today taking to task the Republican Party and the Bush administration, issuing a joint release saying it's a disgrace that tens of thousands of National Guard troops and reservists return home and find they've been laid off, demoted, or denied salary and benefit increases they should have received. The federal government is failing in its responsibility. Support our troops is more than just a slogan, and it is so true. In fact, we're going to be talking with Lynn Novick in about a half hour, or about 15 minutes, actually, the director of the new PBS documentary about war. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, and whatever you'd like here. Jack in Lafarge, Wisconsin. Hey, Jack, what's on your mind today? And
well, to go to the issue of veterans and also the idea of Democrats pushing up from the bottom, we had our Democratic Party, you know, it's a rural county, Vernon County. We have a small assembly district. There's several rural counties, which are blue. They voted for, on the congressional level and national level, blue. But we haven't been able to take the assembly seat. But we were meeting. We have a new guy running. He's a veteran, Vietnam veteran. And he said, you know, we don't think, you know, terrorism is something that you have a war on. And secondly, he said that, you know, as an assembly person, he would kind of like to push for the idea that we honor our veterans by making Veterans Day not only a holiday, but a national day we vote, because that's what we have died and fought for. Mm. I thought that was pretty good. And, you know, again, the rank and file do not like a lot of the leadership on top up in the national. But, you know, when you come down to the grassroots level and the second tier and the state level, they're all on the same page.
Yeah, yeah.
I just wanted to pass that along.
Okay, thanks a lot, Jack. Interesting insight. I'm not sure that making it a voting day, I love the symbolism of it. The practicality of it might, you know, escape us. And, of course, at the federal level, voting is determined by the Constitution, at least voting for Congress, the Senate, for the House, the Senate, and the presidency. Interesting. Very interesting. Thanks a lot. Scott in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I just kind of wanted to comment on what you were talking about with the poll results earlier with the conservatives and liberals and what they listen to and whatnot. And I want to say I think you were right about that, Matt, but I think also that part of the reason that conservatives tend to not listen as much to things besides Fox News and things like that is because I think that people who, at least from what I've seen, the people who tend to be more socially conservative tend to be the people who don't necessarily care that much about what's going on in the world, and they tend to pay more attention to what's going on with Paris Hilton and people like that. So they tend to be very ignorant about the issues, for example, not realizing that, you know, for example, with stem cell research, that it's very different from abortion and things like that.
Sure.
Or that with immigration, you know, clearly it's not hurting the job market in this country that much, because I believe our nationwide unemployment rate is about 4.6% right now.
Yeah, well, that's something we can debate, Scott, but that would be an aside. But I think that your point is well taken, I still haven't figured out whether the conservatives are not listening because they're afraid of what they might hear, or if they're not listening because there's some predisposition there. But your point that they're more interested in the infotainment part of it, it was fascinating. The study that the Media Matters for America, MediaMatters.org, did of Fox News content, and they found that Fox News had far more stories about Anna Nicole Smith, about Britney Spears, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, than any of the other news networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, the CNBC, MSNBCs, or CNN. Far more, far and away more. They're doing much more infotainment and entertainment type stuff, and going out of their way to have what actually, you know, one Fox executive referred to once, probably in a misplaced moment of candor, as eye candy on television. In other words, you know, the very good looking women, scantily clad, or you know, with short skirts, and be sure that you shoot far enough back that you can show that kind of thing. I mean, that's you know, Rupert Murdoch with his British newspapers, the Page Three girls, I think they're called, you know, all the topless girls in his tabloids there. It doesn't fly here, but that's what's going on there. Robert, Newark, California. Hey, Robert.
Yeah, I was trying to say, think that I think you're really wrong about a lot of the independents that sit out there and don't listen to talk radio. Is because basically talk so much of talk radio is not credible. I mean, they basically put up so much of talk radio put out information that is not either true or factual, and that you don't sit back and want to listen. You want to listen to something that is more true and factual. The reason why. The reason why most people look at, you know, Anna Nicole Smith, and many of the, they actually do reporting on those. They actually go find out what is true and what is factual, yeah. And people listen to that.
Well, I have noticed, you know, and I do listen to conservative talk radio with some regularity because it's my competition. I mean, it's I'm driving around, I have to listen to this stuff. And what I've noticed is that, in particular, some of the larger shows are not, increasingly, not dealing with facts and not dealing with what's going on. Increasingly, it's degenerating into personal attacks and liberals this and Muslims that and demagoguery, frankly. And I can understand why an independent would be turned off by that. And I think one of the reasons why, for example, our show is number one on the station in Seattle, number one on the station in San Francisco, number one on the station in Portland, and in many other places around the country is because, you know, we're trying, and some of the other shows on Air America as well that deal with facts are doing very well. And I think I think you've got a point there, Robert, that some people would like to know what's going on as opposed to just hearing, you know, vitriol and anger. Interesting point. Thank you. Ed in San Diego. Hey, Ed.
Oh, yes. Tom, I'm a long-time listener, first call.
Thank you.
Your poll showing that 24% independence isn't going to be listening to 3 weeks before the election scares the heck out of me, because despite your exquisite, I've gotten an education listening to you, but I can hear it now. I'm 79. I've been a lifetime Democrat. The GOP is going to hit the media with the following: the Demos are going to raise your taxes, abort babies, let gays get married, and a few other things, family values, etc. And that's going to flood media.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's why they always wait until the last month before the election. And that's why, you know, the phrase October surprise goes all the way back to Nixon. I mean, Nixon was planning to invade Cuba in the fall of 1960 to unseat John Kennedy. And that went south, and that left John Kennedy inheriting the Bay of Pigs invasion. But the Republicans have been playing that card for a long time.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Not long ago, the Congresses were liberal democratic.
They all hugged trees.
Banned DDTs.
Refused to be pragmatic.
Then voters said our state is red, our message is emphatic.
We want some moral values and a Congress theocratic.
We're super zealous radicals against all things atrocious.
We like Fox News.
They share our views.
Ann Coulter is precocious.
If you cross me, you'll quickly see that we can be ferocious. We're super zealous radicals against all things atrocious.
Yes. Oh, my. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Veterans Day. Or arguably, historically, yesterday, Veterans Day. Actually, it went back to Armistice Day, November 11th, 11-11, on, 19, the end of World War I, in any case, at 11:11 a.m. the armistice was signed that ended World War I and the war to end all wars, and thus this date that we celebrate now as the official bank holiday today. Lynn Novick is with us. She is the co-director of The War, a PBS documentary and war anthem. Lynn, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. My pleasure.
Great to have you with us. I was just looking at this website, soundsofthewar.com, and across the top, big headline, The War, a Ken Burns film, the soundtrack, and people can not only get the soundtrack there and listen to clips of it and buy it, but they can also get the CDs, the box set of CDs there. I didn't see the entire thing. I did see pieces of it on PBS. This is an extraordinary piece of filmmaking.
Thank you very much. It was a privilege for all of us involved, really, to tell the stories of the men and women who lived through the war, and just to do honor to their service and sacrifice by hearing their stories and trying to make sense of them in this very long film.
You and I, being alive today and, you know, being aware of the media, have, I think, probably a reasonably good sense of what's going on with this ongoing occupation in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the plight of the veterans who are coming back right now as services are being cut and you know, they're finding themselves without jobs and things, and so many of them are so badly wounded. I have no recollection of World War II. I was born in 1951. My father served in the occupation forces in Japan, and so he was one of those guys who got the GI Bill. And the GI Bill caused the veterans of World War II to be treated very differently than our veterans are being treated right now. You immersed yourself in World War II as part of, you know, making this film, the War, this Ken Burns film. I'm curious what your thoughts are on the difference. The different zeitgeist, the political differences, the cultural differences, the media differences, the spirit of the times difference between post-World War II, or the returning of the veterans from World War II, and now.
You know, I think in some ways veterans' experiences in war, soldiers' experiences in war, can be very similar across many different wars. You know, the experience of being in combat has certain things that really just cross all kinds of barriers for all different wars, different countries, different experiences that people have. And yet the context in which the wars happen, of course, can't help but affect what it's like for the young men and now men and women to come home, because in World War II, the country was completely united. Everybody was involved. There was a draft, so every young man was involved in the war, and basically most of them were in the military unless there was a reason why they couldn't serve, and most wanted to serve. Not to say everybody wanted to be in combat, of course, but everybody wanted to contribute and do something and be part of the war effort. And little children collected scrap metal and saved stamps for war bonds, and they planted victory gardens. And just every part of daily life was involved in winning the war. And people put aside all kinds of differences and sacrificed and made choices about things they needed or didn't need. So everything that was part of life that had to be done was done to win the war. And the reason for that is because it was a war that was necessary and that had to be won. The stakes were incredibly high, and everybody knew that. And even the reporters, they felt themselves to be part of the war effort. They didn't want to report anything that would be too upsetting to the people at home. They felt their job was to, you know, boost morale and to present the best possible picture of what was going on so that everyone could keep working as hard as possible to win the war. And since then, we've had very divisive wars and unpopular wars and wars that haven't gone well. And so I can only imagine for the people who've served in those wars how difficult it could be to come home and not be recognized necessarily for the service they have given, which is just as difficult, if not more difficult, than in World War II, but the country wasn't as united.
When you and Ken Burns and the people working on your documentary were interviewing all the veterans from World War II, and I think that's a good chunk of what I saw in the documentary.
Right.
It was so poignant, so incredibly poignant, and so powerful, frankly. I'm wondering what their thoughts were about the World War II, because this is primarily World War II veterans. That's the war that you're talking about. What their thoughts were relative about veterans of wars since then, specifically, largely, I'd guess, Vietnam and Iraq.
Well, I think they feel a tremendous kinship with anyone who's been in war. You know, there's this solidarity of experience that they've had. And so they feel tremendous respect and empathy for anyone who's served and who has sacrificed and been part of a military effort. And yet they also recognize that their particular service in World War II was different in the way that the war was won and that they were greeted as heroes when they came home. So I think they feel, to some degree, some pain for the younger veterans having, you know, a different experience coming back and not being given the respect necessarily or the accolades, you know, that they felt.
Yeah.
That being said, I think some of them have the same kinds of, they're haunted by some of the same ghosts, I would say.
Sure.
Of just what it was like to be in a place where those of us who haven't been in combat really can just barely imagine or hope to understand what is expected of the people that we send or that, you know, volunteer to be involved in that.
War is organized killing. It's organized mass
murder. Exactly. And there's no getting around it. I'm so sorry that, it is terrible, really. It's just, you know, the people that are involved in it, they never really get over it in a way. They keep on living.
Yeah.
And it becomes part of who they are. And the thing that struck me the most, and I did most of the interviews for the film, the men who were involved in the actual killing, and often that was accompanied by incredible loss of life and, you know, injury to themselves and to their comrades as well. So they had to deal with trauma on many different levels. The thing that has haunted them the most is the fact that they were participating in killing other human beings, even if they were the enemy, even if it was their job. It was still incredibly difficult, and they think about it every day.
One more argument to end war for all time, as we had hoped World War I would do, as we hoped World War II would do. Lynn Novick, the co-director of The War, a PBS documentary. You can check it out at soundsofthewar.com.
Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
Well, there's a lot of interesting news. Welcome back to the second hour of the program, by the way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from New York City. A lot of interesting things in the news that all seems to have to do with this larger theme of our economic present and future. October 29th, 1929, 29-29, in the month of October, was, you know, the day of the big crash. But fascinating, my dad used to have one of these coffee table books. The front pages of the New York Times, great big book with the front page, and there was a whole bunch of them from the first few days thereafter and through 29 and 30 in particular. And it took a while for it to sink in. I mean, for weeks, for months afterwards. In fact, for the better part of a year afterwards, you had even pundits saying, now's a great time to buy into the market. And boy, it couldn't get better and blah, 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 blah. And people didn't realize on 29-29 of October, on October 29th of 1929, on Black Tuesday, that really was the beginning of the Great Depression. And there are some who are suggesting that another odd confluence of numbers, that in the 11th month, on the 7th day of the 7th year, which would be, you know, 7-11-7, again, the day and the year tying together, the month being off, last Wednesday, that we might have begun down the road toward a Great Depression in the United States, in part because that was the day that the Chinese announced that they were going to stop or dramatically scale back their purchase of U.S. debt instruments. They're not going to loan us any more money. They're not going to buy our treasuries. And that they were going to start selling our treasuries. And there's this whole broad and as well as a number of other nations. And there's a whole broad spectrum of just fascinating little bits and pieces in today's news that I want to draw together for you, like pulling together a jigsaw puzzle or pulling together the threads to make a scarf or a sweater or whatever. Given the weather here, you can tell what I'm thinking of. It's cold in New York. That makes sense. That makes sense. Today in the Wall Street Journal, the page 6, full page article, big headline or half page article, big headline across, it's all above the fold. U.S. digs into guard Iraq oil experts. Long term presence planned at Persian Gulf terminals viewed as vulnerable. Chip Cummings writing his Dateline, the Qar el Amaya oil terminal, Iraq. That's where he's writing from. He says the U.S. Navy is building a military installation atop this petroleum export platform as the U.S. establishes a more lasting military mission in the oil-rich northern Persian Gulf. While presidential candidates debate whether to start bringing ground troops home from Iraq, the new construction suggests that one footprint of U.S. military power in Iraq isn't shrinking anytime soon. American officials are girding for an open-ended commitment to protect the country's oil industry. This region, he notes, produces almost a third of the world's oil. He goes on to say, Iraq's once powerful oil industry is still a point of nationalistic pride among most Iraqis. Oil officials in Baghdad have mixed feelings about the U.S. presence atop, and it's quite literally atop, one of their country's most important pieces of energy infrastructure. So there's that. Okay, so just kind of put that in your bio computer, and let's look at some of these other things, some of these other stories. Going to the Financial Times, which has been all last week, every single day last week, and over the weekend, a startling article I read on the plane from San Francisco on whatever day I flew out here, Saturday, that was talking about, well, the meme, the main meme for the Financial Times for the whole last week is you know, worldwide, you know, kind of a global financial freakout. I believe it was USB, the Swiss bank, one of the big banks, announced that this year that the maximum Christmas bonus that they were giving their bankers, you know, Christmas bonus, you know how you get the, you know, $50 in your check at the end of the year. Hey, go out and buy yourself something, kid. You know, $100, whatever. It used to be a big deal back, you know, I remember in the 60s and 70s and 80s, every business gave Christmas bonuses. It's more rare now. I'm guessing probably only a minority of companies do it. But the Wall Street banks, they do it big time. And they announced, this announcement was in the Financial Times, that, as I recall, it was USB, announced that the maximum cash Christmas bonus that they were passing out per person was only going to be $750,000. That was the maximum Christmas bonus this year for their traders and their personal bankers and their investment bankers and whatnot. Only $750,000. That's it. Sorry. In the past, it might have been 5 or 10 or 20 or 50 or 75 million bucks for Christmas bonus. But this year, only $750,000. So there's some real pain being felt down on Wall Street right now, I can tell you. I mean, it's just... So put that in your bio computer and in your brain for a minute and look at the front page story in today's Financial Times. Pentagon talks down imminent Iran strike. Here's a picture of William Fallon, the head of CENTCOM. That's, you know, he's basically the commander of all of the military in the Middle East, the U.S. military in the Middle East, Central Command. And he holds a press conference. And in fact, Bush was there for part of it. He holds his press conference and says, well, actually, let me just quote his own words, as quoted in the Financial Times. The headline, this is the major story in today's Financial Times of London, which is arguably the world's most respected conservative, as it were, financial publication, news publication. Pentagon talks down imminent Iran strike. Say what? The military is contradicting Dick Cheney? Well, here's the article from Dmitry Sevastopolo and Daniel Dobley and Andrew Ward in Washington. The Pentagon is not preparing a preemptive attack on Iran in spite of an increase in bellicose rhetoric from Washington, according to senior officers. Admiral William Fallon, head of Central Command, which oversees military operations in the Middle East, told the Financial Times that while dealing with Iran was a, quote, challenge, end quote, quote, a strike is not in the offing, end quote. Fallon goes on to say, now keep in mind, this is a quote from the guy who's holding the job that before that was held by Abba Zaid, and before that and on and on. Before that, I think it was Zinni, who says, none of this is helped by the stories that just keep going round and around and around that any day now there will be another war, which is just not where we want to go. Admiral Fallon did not rule out the possibility of an attack, but his comments served as a shot across the bow of hawks who argue for imminent action. They also echo the views of the senior brass that military action should only be considered as an absolute last resort. Are we reaching the point where the military is going to push back against the Republicans in the House and the Senate and the White House? Where the military is saying, I mean, having the military call a press conference and speak about foreign policy is, in my experience, almost unheard of. I mean, you've got, you know, poor, deluded General Petraeus doing his very best, being voted number one conservative of the year by some website over out there. You've got him wandering into the realm of politics. And now here, Admiral William Fallon saying, no, guys, we don't think that there should be a war. I mean, I'm not quoting, I'm paraphrasing. Joanne Hart, an Iran expert at Brown University who consults for the military, says the U.S. might think in terms of limited strike, but military officers like to point out that the enemy has a vote. This, I'm still quoting from the Financial Times here. Retired General Anthony Zinni, a former CENTCOM commander, said that the U.S. military was, quote, stretched too thin to fight a protracted war with Iran. Retired General John Abizaid, who preceded Admiral Fallon as head of CENTCOM, recently said the U.S. should avoid a war with Iran, which would, quote, be devastating for everybody, end quote. He also said the U.S. should do everything they can to prevent Iran from getting nuclear weapons, but if they get them, quote, Washington can live with that outcome if it happens. So we've got that. Isn't that interesting, you know, kind of cranking that down? At the same time now, as oil is becoming increasingly scarce and prices are being driven up, money is moving out of the dollar. And this is where it's getting really, really spooky. And I'll share the substance of this with you right after the break. But this is OPEC seems poised now to move away from the dollar and toward what they call a basket of currencies. And the Financial Times, again, reporting on this today. And if this happens suddenly, and it seems like it might be, then the dollar is poised for even another big collapse. And it might be a tough time here. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Thanks for the heads up from Fred in the chat room. Interesting blog over at currencytrading.net. Jessica Hupp writing about, it's no secret that the dollar's on a downward spiral. She notes seven countries considering abandoning the U.S. dollar. Now, this was written about a week ago. Actually, yeah, November 6th. Number one, Saudi Arabia. The Telegraph reporting that Saudi Arabia is talking, it has refused to cut their interest rates along with the U.S. Fed. Typically, they had essentially pegged their currency to the dollar. This is a break from that, and perhaps the beginning of one, and I'll take you up to today in just a moment. Number two, South Korea. In 2005, they announced their intention to shift their investments to currencies of other countries. Whispers that the Bank of Korea is planning on selling $1 billion in U.S. bonds after having just sold $100 million this past August. China, after already dropping the dollar peg in 2005... is threatening a nuclear option on dropping the dollar, no longer buying our debt. This is what I said last Wednesday, 7-11-07. Venezuela is establishing barter deals with countries rather than deal with dollars. The Sudan, an oil producer, is converting their dollar holdings into the euro and other currencies. Iran, of course, has opened an oil bourse, and they're talking about a commodity exchange, the Iranian oil bourse. It hasn't fully opened yet in a big way, but they're so far they've missed three of their opening dates. But 85% of revenue from this country is coming from oil exports. They're loving these high oil prices. And the same for Russia. Russia, again, Vladimir Putin has talked about establishing a Russian stock exchange, which would allow, quoting Putin, allow gas and other goods to be paid for in rubles, In other words, they want to make their currency a major player. Now we come to today's Financial Times. This is page 2. A couple of interesting pieces that just kind of pull all this together. I mean, just as you're looking at what's going on in the world, Sheila McNulty in Houston reporting for the Financial Times. The big five international oil companies have cut exploration spending in real terms between 98 and 2006, failing to respond to the incentive of high prices. Now, this is interesting. ExxonMobil, BP, Chevron, Royal Dutch Shell, and ConocoPhillips used 56% of their increased operating cash flow on share buybacks and dividends instead of exploration. In other words, the big American oil company, or the big five oil companies that are doing most of their business in the United States, or much of their business in the United States, the American big five, even though Shell and BP are owned outside the United States, are basically converting oil into profits for their shareholders, who in the United States can take those profits and only pay a maximum 15% income tax when they take it as dividends. Now, two of these companies, Shell and British Petroleum, are actually branching out into, again, to quote the Financial Times, branching out into investing, Shell, for example, investing $22 billion to develop an energy portfolio including second-generation biofuels, wind energy, and unconventional fuels. Now, okay, you take that. Now, Venezuela is talking. This is another article by Javier Blas. Wealth flows into currencies. The recycling of large sums of petrodollars. This is all about, you know, what's happening with all these dollars out there that are being used for oil. There's a mind-boggling amount of money going into the oil-rich nations. I mean, OPEC's total revenue right now is about $600 billion, whereas in 2000, when George Bush came into office, it was around $120 billion. Now it's over $600. It's forecast to end the year at $700 billion. So many of these countries are, instead of pricing things in oil, Venezuela has claimed that OPEC members will discuss at this summit that they're having this week and next the creation of a currency basket to price its oil. The currency will include the dollar, the euro, the yen, the pound sterling, and the Swiss franc. They call it the modified Geneva One basket. Any move to boost the importance of the basket could lead the cartel to seek a higher oil price in the event of further dollar weakness. In other words, what it would do is it would cause the price of oil to go up in dollars. But for people in European countries whose currency is the euro or the Swiss franc or the British pound, the price of oil wouldn't be going up. Because what they're all acknowledging is that 26 years of Reaganomics has destroyed the dollar. Ronald Reagan's economic policies, which have been continued by every president since him, I'd say with regard to balancing the budget, Bill Clinton kind of slowed it down, but he certainly didn't roll back Reagan's tax cuts. Ronald Reagan's economic policies, 26 years of this, have destroyed the dollar, and these countries are saying, enough already. We're not going to pay in dollars, which are becoming worth less. September oil prices rose almost 9% in dollar terms, but only about 6.5% when measured by the wider currency basket. You get this? The other countries of the world are starting to say, enough already, you guys. America, you know, if you're gonna spend yourself into bankruptcy, if you're gonna bankrupt your families, if you're gonna have these an insane war that's costing $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 per family in the United States, and you're gonna pay for it on credit, we're not gonna finance it anymore by making the dollar the reserve currency of the world.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Okay, so you got it. Here we have here's the situation in a nutshell. Massive amounts of wealth, particularly from the United States, are now flowing into the Middle East, where I mean, literally, mountains are being built for skiing in the desert indoors. The conspicuous consumption on a level unimaginable. I mean, they make the robber barons look like pikers. So our wealth is flowing out. Our manufacturing has all gone to China. All of this you can track right back to Ronald Reagan coming into office and saying, oh, Jimmy Carter's idea of America never, never importing more oil than we did in 1978? That's silly. We need to import lots of oil. After all, you know, our oil companies need to make more money. And after all, they help fund my election. So number one, Reagan saying no to conservation, no to alternative energy, no to, so he put us in this situation. And then Reagan also doubling and then tripling our national debt. And then Bush doubling it again, taking us at $9 trillion national debt. It was at $1 trillion when Reagan came into office. A trillion, by the way, 1,000 billion. A billion, by the way, 1,000 million. So let's see. We could give $1 million Americans $1 million each. That's $1 trillion. Or we could give the math of it. So and now the world is starting to say, okay, we've seen the consequences of Reaganomics. We've seen how it's destroying your currency. We've seen how it's destroyed your infrastructure. We see that your bridges are falling apart. We see that your schools are disintegrating. You're not producing engineers like you used to. You're not, you know, people can't even afford to go to college in America anymore. We're giving up on America. That's what the rest of the world is saying. And we're certainly giving up on the dollar because you've got a bunch of these right-wing crackpots who've been running your economic policy from Alan Greenspan to Tom Friedman to Milton Friedman to, right across the board from the pundits to the politicians wrecking this country. Meanwhile, the people still have some power in France, and Sarkozy, see, this whatever you want to call it, corporatism, neoliberalism, whatever you want to call it, Sarkozy wants to go down this road. He wants to become, they call him Sarko the American, right? Well, the French people are having nothing of it. This is today's Financial Times. Nicolas Sarkozy's commitment to reforming France's pension system. Right? In other words, he's trying to privatize their equivalent of Social Security. And reforming their labor market. He's trying to say, no, you can't have required by law 4 weeks a year of vacation any longer. And you can't have, a maximum 35 or 40 hour week, whatever it is nowadays in France. And, let's give employers more power and unions less power. They're shutting down the country. Nicolas Sarkozy's commitment to reforming France's pension system and labor market. This is the language, obviously, of a conservative business publication. Will be put to its toughest test yet this week. And why is this not being hugely reported in the United States, by the way? Well, because they don't want us to get any ideas, right? With unions threatening to paralyze the country with a second round of transport strikes and demonstrations, rail workers protesting against government plans to roll back their pension privileges are set to begin an open-ended strike tomorrow. The protests this week could take on even greater significance as unions representing other groups and trades look to join in on the protests. Calls have gone out to students who are currently protesting changes in the university system. So you can go to college in France right now all the way up to a PhD for free. And Sarkozy says, no, let's do what Ronald Reagan did to the University of California system. Let's do away with that free college education. Well, students are saying, say what? Calls have gone out to students who are currently protesting about changes in the university system to back the day of action. Last week, the railway station in Rennes was closed down temporarily after students invaded the tracks. Judges and courtroom staff will also go on strike on November 29 to protest a reform of the judicial map in France. He's messing with the courts just like the right-wingers have here. Sarkozy says But with public opinion firmly behind Mr. Sarkozy, oddly enough, he's been able to convince most French that reform is necessary. We got to do something. Well, people get it. You got to do something. Okay, not the right thing. I mean, see, most Americans thought Reagan made some sense, too, at a certain point, in the early 80s. His popularity was what, 70-some-odd percent? The government says it's not planning to cede ground. The Prime Minister, François Fillon, says there is no other solution to save the pension system than reform. Have we heard that song before? And finally, and this is fascinating news, just a quickie. The Kevin Martin, the Republican who's chairman of the FCC. There's two Republicans, two Democrats, and the chairman. So there's three Republicans and two Democrats, basically. Kevin Martin, the chairman, has come out and said that he thinks that cable, there's this provision in law that says that when 70% of American homes have cable and when 70% of Americans have subscribed to cable, then cable gets to be regulated by the FCC. And he says, we're there now. I'd like the power to regulate. And the Republicans are freaking out. So we'll see where that one goes. Interesting. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Mike in Burbank, California. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, I wanted to talk about backing up the dollar with gold the way they did it with the Bretton Woods Agreement.
Right. We're going back now to
1944.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I think of gold as a, well.
Although the dollar had really been backed by gold ever since, I mean, you know, the first bank of the U.S. In the, what was it, 1800-something, and then the second bank of the U.S. that came about in the 1830s, as I recall, went bankrupt in the 1840s. And then when we got a federal currency in 1913, you know, with the Federal Reserve, it was still backed by gold, wasn't it, right up through Nixon, 72?
Nixon was the one who stopped the gold back
right.
in 1971.
Yeah, if I recall my history of all that correctly.
Yeah, so
anyway,
I mean,
your point.
What I was calling to say was that back when the gold was backing the dollar, it was artificially set by the government or by some authority at $35 an ounce.
Right.
And my question to you, sir, is that if they were to try to stabilize the value of our dollar by rebacking it with gold, would they set it at such an artificially low figure that any investments that we were to make now at $800 an ounce would be wiped out?
No, it'd probably be actually the other way around, Mike, because if you're going to set a currency against gold, you actually have to have physically the gold reserves. And our gold reserves right now are much less than they were during World War II and during that, you know, right up till Nixon. We've been selling off our gold reserves. And so we have so little gold right now relative to the number of dollars in circulation that if we were to set the dollar relative to an ounce of gold, my guess would be it would be at least $2,000 an ounce. And it may well be $4,000 or $5,000 an ounce. I'm sure somebody who's, you know, very into gold and the monetary system could tell us that. But it definitely wouldn't be lower than what it is right now. It would be dramatically higher.
You mean the government would have to pay $2,000 to get an ounce of gold?
That's right. That's right.
So all of us taxpayers would have to pay $2,000.
That's right. Yeah.
That's why
it's not going to happen. I mean, when Nixon shut that down. And then particularly with the damage that Reagan has done, and since then, you know, with this massive deficit spending, and you know, we're spending $300 billion a year now just on the interest on the debt that Ronald Reagan ran up, and I mean that's more than at the federal level, and we spent on education and housing. I mean, it's mind-boggling, and that's just on the debt. That's just the interest payments, and so we're not going to go back to gold. What we have to maintain a currency based on the faith and trust of the United States, you know, on the integrity of the U.S. economy, and that's the good news, and it's also the bad news, because as long as these guys are running the economy, we're in big trouble. Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Don in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Don.
Hi, Tom.
What's up?
Hey, I caught part of your segment about the conservative thing in the poll, and I got the gist of it, and I'm a conservative checking in.
Oh, great. Well, see, now it didn't say all conservatives don't listen to talk radio. It said about 7% of conservatives listen to progressive talk radio, and about 20% of liberals are willing to listen to conservative talk radio. I think it was 23%. I don't have it in front of me any longer. But it wasn't zero, so you're part of the proud 7%, Don.
I think I'm a well-rounded conservative. I watch OPB. I have timber, and I believe in logging and all that. But yet, my job in Portland, I pick up all the illegal dump sites in the city. So for environmentalism, I take care of the city quite well. But
yeah.
I don't know. I was listening to somebody. I kind of caught about watching Fox News. I don't have cable or satellite. I have rabbit ears. But the Brittany thing and the who's the other blonde gal? Paris Hilton thing. I could care less. I'm into politics. I listen to your side. I listen to the Young Turks. I listen to Randy Rhodes, but then I listen to Lars and I listen to Bill O'Reilly. So.
Yep. Well, Don, I salute you. You're a well-rounded individual, and I hope that you get active in the Republican Party because they need thoughtful people like you. And I thank you very much for calling. Well said, David in Everett, Washington. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom. This is a contrarian call about economics. and I hope you follow me on this. If demand drove supply, then Africa should have a great economy because they got all kinds of demand. What Africa doesn't have is investment. So they don't have a supply.
Well, yes and no. I've actually worked in Africa. Let's continue this conversation, David. Stick around for a minute. I'd like to get into this with you, but we have to take a break. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. What's the future of the economy in the United States? Have we started the slide into a Great Depression? Let's hope not.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Not Buddha, not Allah, not God sets us free. Not the person up front saying, listen to me. I won't give up my rights to a mere pack of thieves. Wearing suits and big smiles with a trick up each sleeve. Cause it's our right to know all that they do. And they don't do a thing unless we tell them to. Cause they represent us, not those big wigs uptown. They wanna fight about that, then I'll go a few rounds. I'll stand and let my voice be heard. I'll stand and let my voice be heard. I'll stand up, speak out. This is still my country. I'll stand and let my voice ring free.
Amen, my brother. 9.5 minutes before the hour. David Neverett, Washington. We have to wrap this up real quickly because we have Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. But, again, your statement. Take a shot.
This is David. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're talking to me?
Yeah.
Okay. Just real quick, man. I'll try to go through this quick. Supply. Say's law holds. Supply drives demand, but you have to have investment first. To supply, you create workers, and that's the demand.
Okay. Then so you're buying into the belief that employers create jobs. You said create workers. Let me agree with you that you have
to.
Yeah, you said if it wasn't, you know, for lack of investment, that's why Africa is so poor. And I've worked in Africa, and I can tell you that there are cities. I've worked in Nairobi, for example. There's a large middle class in Nairobi, and the difference between Nairobi and, for example, Jinja, Uganda, where I've also worked, which is a backwater. Is not investment by big multinational corporations or by wealthy people. It's in government investment. So in as much as investment is necessary for an economy to work, you're absolutely right, but it's investment by government in infrastructure. You must have the institutions of civil society. You must have roads, public education, clean and potable water, good sewage, good electric infrastructure, good communications infrastructure, and by and large, those are always provided by government. Government investment is necessary, and then on the basis of that government investment, the people who have the demand will ask for a product which will then be provided to them. But to simply say, hey, I'm going to build a factory and make giant purple round things, and people are going to buy them simply because there's a supply of them, that's crazy.
No, it's not crazy because, I mean, they wouldn't buy it. Investors have to estimate what individuals. You wouldn't have a government if you don't have a productive economy. The productive economy supports the government. It creates the government.
No, I'd say it's the absolute other way around. And I can tell you again, from having worked in countries where there is no government, that you cannot have a productive economy without a functioning government.
Well, even if you had a government that supplied all the investment, that was tried in Russia, the Soviet Union, it was tried in China.
I'm talking about investment in the commons, not investment. What Russia did was they tried to build the car factory and the shoe factory. That was stupid. But they did build roads and infrastructure, which is now being used by capitalists in Russia who are doing very well, thank you very much.
We did that in the 30s. If you don't have any cars to drive on the road, if the productive economy is not working, I mean, even John Keynes knew that it was lack of investment that was caused. His whole theory was contingent on the multiplier effect. He was trying to get capital investment going.
That was because there was a liquidity crisis in the 30s, and they couldn't get more money out of the central banks. They weren't willing to.
There was lack of demand for liquidity.
There was lack of demand because people didn't have income.
Demand. Well, the reason is, the reason...
There was a lack of demand for liquidity. There were Americans all over the country who would have borrowed if they could have. They just couldn't.
When you have contracting prices and when you have oppressive taxation, tariffs, and labor unions, there's the risk is too high and the reward's too low.
No,
for
I'd say
you're not going to have investment in the private sector.
Then why do you have France and Sweden and Denmark and Finland and Norway as some of the highest standard of living countries in the world, where you have very, very strong governments and you have very, very strong labor unions and you have very well regulated or highly regulated corporate activity?
Well, it's no question. It's a balancing act. There's a lot of things that we're subsidizing for the rest of the world, including security. But,
David, let's have this. I think we've both made our points, and let's have this conversation again, and perhaps in more depth, because I love this kind of conversation. But I it's time for Victoria Jones to come in. I appreciate the call, and call another day, and we'll continue it. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria, I know we only have a minute or two left. What's up in Washington?
Well, obviously, Washington is basically closed for Veterans Day, and people's minds are very much on Veterans Day. But I thought you might be interested to hear a story that's appearing in yesterday's Observer newspaper out of the UK, which is the privately contracted interrogators who are working for the US forces in Iraq. They're telling the Observer that the US military is putting an awful lot of pressure on them to get incriminating evidence pointing to Iran out of the insurgents who they're questioning.
Right. And one of them even said that information on Iran is gold, which implies that they're being paid well for it. And
right.
And he also said, it's not about torture, but if somebody wants to get out of jail and he knows to say what I want to hear, I'll let him out of jail if he says what I want to hear. And it was reported in the Observer. It's over at you can read it at the top of commondreams.org as well as the on the Observer website. That was a startling story to read. I was amazed. That guy, he went public with his name and picture, and I have a feeling he's unemployed today.
Yes, as indeed are a number of our country's veterans. I spoke with Senator Jim Webb this morning, who was on our radio show, and he was talking about the extraordinary number of vets who are coming back and are finding that they haven't got the jobs that they had when they left. And we were talking about how people don't have the jobs and the laws are not being enforced, and the extraordinary amount of time it takes to try and get a case to court. Also how veterans are not able to get care in veterans facilities, as of course you know, and the extraordinary cost of the medical care and disability benefits we're going to have that could in fact exceed the amount spent so far in prosecuting the war in Iraq.
Yeah, it could, and there are some estimates it could be as high as $2 trillion. Which is truly, truly mind-bending. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thanks so much, and thanks for patiently hanging on there as I was finishing my debate.
Fascinating.
Thank you. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Aliza Marcus is with us, the author of Blood and Belief, the PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence. NYU Press published it, nyupress.org, the website where you can learn more about it. Aliza, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. I think the PKK and the whole Kurdish thing in general is something that most Americans are just profoundly confused about. Give us, first of all, a little bit of backstory, the history of Kurdistan, the history of the Kurdish people.
Basically, the Kurdish people have lived, they're from Iran, what is currently Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and Syria, in that area where the borders intersect. And in the 1920s, when these states were formed, the Kurds were split up among these four countries. And ever since then, there have been intermittent Kurdish revolts where the Kurds in these countries have tried to gain greater rights, if not autonomy or independence.
To what extent are the Kurds visibly distinct, religiously distinct, racially, ethnically, language? I mean, what are the things that cause a Kurd to know that he or she is a Kurd?
It's basically a language issue. They speak a different language. They don't speak Arabic or Turkish, which are their, or Farsi, the languages of that region. They have tribal links. They have very close families, tribes. But other than that, they're almost indistinguishable. They share the same religion, Islam, and they look visibly like everybody else in the region. That may be one of their problems. The states there think that they can easily integrate them because they look just like everybody else and they have the same religion.
But their language goes back thousands of years, doesn't it?
Their language goes back very far. Nobody really knows exactly where it comes from, but it's very distinct and separates them.
In a way, this kind of reminds me of the Basques in Spain. I remember when I was living in Europe, I read a fascinating book on European languages, and they said that the only language for which they can't figure out the origin, you know, it's not Indo-European, it doesn't go back to Sanskrit, it doesn't go back to Norsk. The only language is the Basque language. There is no discernible beginning point for it. And,
wow.
and the Basques themselves have this myth that, or this belief that they're the descendants of a lost continent, you know, and thus the Atlantis thing. Do the Turks or do the Kurds have some sort of similar creation story about themselves and their for example, the Hebrew creation story, you know, Genesis, the Jewish creation story, Adam and Eve's son went off to the next town over and married a woman from the community there. So obviously it's not about the creation of the human race. It's about the creation of that tribe. And when you look at most tribes' creation stories, they all start out with the first man and woman of that tribe. Do the Kurds have a story like that?
Yes, they do. They have something similar, the first man and woman living in the mountains somewhere, producing the rest of this race. And they have within each region there, each Kurdish group will have like slightly different versions of this creation. But you know, the Kurds haven't really been able to study their history very well because they've been repressed a lot in these countries. So they don't have a well-developed sense of history about their past or culture, that at least not one that we know about.
Yeah. Now, a friend of mine actually, who's now 93 and was in Hitler's army, parachuted into Kurdistan during World War II to help the Kurds take the oil fields from, you know, and give them to the Germans from the Brits. He was immediately arrested and spent the whole rest of the war, he says, much to his relief, and you know, he never had to kill anybody in a prisoner of war camp. But he created the flag that I believe the PKK is using. There were two Kurdish groups at that time who were kind of competing for control of Greater Kurdistan.
Mm-hmm.
And what are those two groups, and are they still around? Where did the PKK come from? What did they evolve out of?
Well, the PKK came out of really the Turkish left in the 1970s, and they were sort of they were university dropouts, mainly political science students, and they decided the only way to get a Kurdish state was by fighting Turkey for it.
Mm-hmm.
So they subsequently they fled to Syria and Lebanon because there was a coup in Turkey and they couldn't operate there, and that's really where they got their training and their beginning.
Hmm. And what were the groups prior to the PKK?
Before the PKK, there were mainly two groups active, as you mentioned. There was one in Iran, Iranian Kurdish group, that very briefly in around 1947 had an independent state. And then there were the Iraqi Kurds.
Mm-hmm.
So the Iraqi Kurds have really been at the forefront of this for decades.
Yeah. So is the PKK and the Iraqi Kurds, are they at loggerheads?
Basically, especially now, because Turkey's threatening to invade northern Iraq because the PKK is there, and this is putting pressure on the Iraqi Kurds to do something about these Turkish-Kurdish rebels.
So the PKK is primarily among the Kurds in Turkey who want an independent Kurdistan in that part of Turkey where they've historically lived. It's primarily a phenomena of Turkish.
Yes, it's a Turkish-Kurdish group. To make it even more confusing, all the Kurds in the region have their own groups.
Right.
And at times these groups fight against each other.
That's right.
Sometimes they fight together, so it can be very difficult to follow.
Yeah. Barsoud Armani, or there's a name something?
Masoud Barzani.
Masoud Barzani. Who is he?
He's the president now of the Kurdistan Autonomous Region, which is in northern Iraq. It's one of the regions now in Iraq that has autonomy. And his father was a great Kurdish fighter, Mullah Mustafa Barzani.
Mm.
The United States actually helped in the 60s and 70s. And Masoud Barzani has been hoping that Turkey won't invade because this would be incredibly destabilizing to the mini-state that he's trying to build up.
Yeah, interesting.
But he he used to be quite friendly with the PKK. Now he's a little more suspicious of them, but he doesn't want to take action against the Turkish Kurds because one reason is that everybody there is a Kurd, and he doesn't feel like fighting against other Kurds.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Yes, that works well in that
Yeah. So what? How, from an American point of view, what should we be thinking and doing about all? By the way, we're talking with Lisa Marcus. She's the author of Blood and Belief: The PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence. And this is, I mean, this has been simmering ever since the end of World War One, when basically the Brits and others just carved this area up arbitrarily into these countries. What's the ultimate resolution, and what does this have to do with us?
It's very difficult to figure out how to solve this because it's a problem that has to be solved in Turkey, in Iran, in Iraq, and Syria. So there's not simply one solution. What it has to do with us right now is that we're very busy in Iraq fighting insurgents. And the last thing we want is for Turkey to invade northern Iraq and destabilize this one part of the country that right now has been peaceful. And Turkey's also putting pressure on us to send soldiers to northern Iraq and fight the PKK. And this isn't a war that the United States really wants or needs to get involved with.
Well, that would really upset the Kurds in northern Iraq, would it not?
It would upset the Kurds in northern Iraq. And frankly, the Kurds have been generally very pro-American. And this would turn them against us, and we probably don't need that.
Well, and in fact, they've been fairly reliable military allies down in the Shia and Sunni areas because the American soldiers know that the Kurds aren't going to suddenly, you know, melt into the local populace or take sides with their ethnic, brethren because they're not Shia or Sunni.
That's right, and they're great allies, and they're also very experienced fighters.
Right.
And they've been very effective in helping the U.S., so we need to think about that.
Yeah. You said that the Kurds are Muslim.
Right.
Are they Shia, Sunni, or some whole brand new variety?
Mainly Sunni. They also have other varieties inside of them, Alevi, and it's sort of a mixture. But the Kurds generally are not strongly religious. You know, they're very traditional,
mm-hmm.
but they're not, they don't bend towards an extremist view of religion.
So the odds of Kurdistan, if the UN were to get together, for example, and negotiate a deal with these four countries and say, okay, we're going to create a greater Kurdistan and give the Kurds their country, you know, what they had before 1920 back, or arguably, I guess they were oppressed by the Ottoman Empire before that, but nonetheless, say give them back Kurdistan, it would not be a fundamentalist Islamic state.
It would highly unlikely.
It would probably be secular.
It would probably be secular, with Islam having some sort of role, but in a very sort of secondary role. I think the biggest problem would be that the Kurds might fight among themselves because they've been separated for so long by borders.
Right. It seems, though, that would be an outcome or an option that the United States would have the greatest, that would benefit us the greatest, because it would provide, you know, at least one stable state in the region.
That's possible. Or they could look for a more sort of localized solution, which is that in each country, the Kurds could have autonomy or some sort of federation.
Right, which is what they're fighting for in Iraq right now, what has been proposed, the kind of Biden deal and what is going on right now de facto, is it not?
It is. And it's leaning, it's developing towards an independent state. And there are, of course, some people who support the idea of Iraq being split up into three states.
Yeah, well, although Turkey is freaking out at the idea of a Kurdish independent state.
They're absolutely opposed to it.
Amazing. It's an amazing, complex, profound, and frankly, ultimately important because of our involvement in the area, story. The article, Blood and Belief, the PKK and the Kurdish Fight for Independence, the author, Lisa Marcus. New York University Press, NYUPress.org. Thanks, Elisa.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. Terry O'Sullivan on the line with us. He's the general president of the Laborers International Union, of North America, LIUNA.org, the website. Hey, Terry, welcome to the program.
Thanks again for having me, Tom.
Great to have you with us. The Whiskey Falls, putting Working Man on the chart.
There you go. How do you like that?
Tell us about this.
I'll tell you. This band came, they did a song called Working Man, and they contacted our union and said that they'd like to make a donation to our charitable foundation for every time the song is played. So we made them the official band of the Laborers International Union.
That's great. That's absolutely great. And the song is Working Man, and the band is Whiskey Falls. Check it out. In fact, you can find it over at liuna.org. There's a link to it. You guys are ramping up a search for a Build America candidate. Tell us about this.
Well, we're still in the process. We've polled our membership. As I told you before, we had a leadership conference in September where we webcast to all of our members the major presidential candidates. Hillary Clinton was there. We had John Edwards. We had Bill Richardson. And we had Joe Biden. And we polled our membership in September. We're going to poll them again in probably November and December. And at the point in which one of the candidates gets 60% of our membership support, is probably that point we'll come out and endorse one of the candidates.
So it's a supermajority. Yeah,
that makes sense. We want to make sure, Tom, that it's not a leadership endorsement, but that it's a membership endorsement.
Right.
So that's why we're taking the extra step to make sure that our membership really rallies around and supports which of the candidates they support will come out and endorse.
Right. There's a number of things here on your website at liuna.org that I'd love to talk to you about. I'm just curious, though, first, before I'm driving the agenda here, if there's something that you wanted to put on the table and talk about.
I just like, last week was historic as far as I'm concerned. We passed a much-needed water bill. It was a $23 billion water infrastructure bill.
Right.
And what was great about it was that the president, in his infinite wisdom, or lack thereof, decided to veto the bill, and his veto was beaten back in both the House and the Senate.
Right.
So this is a jobs bill. It'll put about almost 1.1 million people to work. About half of those jobs are good family-supporting construction jobs. So I was glad that the Congress finally stood up to this president and put their money where their mouth is, because our water infrastructure is crumbling, and this was a much-needed bill. So.
Yeah. What do you want to bet, Terry, once those jobs start taking hold and you start seeing some small economic revival in some parts of the country, that Bush is going to show up in those places campaigning for a local Republican and taking credit for it because he signed the bill?
Of course he will.
Yeah.
You know what's crazy, Tom, is that this bill in particular, it goes towards the protection of the Gulf Coast from future hurricanes and flooding following the deaths of 1,800 people, which we all know what FEMA did or didn't do during that hurricane. And a lot of this money goes towards rebuilding those levees, and this guy vetoed the bill. It's just another sign of his lack of direction, his lack of leadership when it comes to doing the things that need to be done to build up the infrastructure in this country and to protect people.
Indeed. We're talking with Terry O'Sullivan, the general president of the Laborers International Union of North America. Liuna.org is their website. Terry, it's Veterans Day. Thoughts on how the labor movement in the United States is helping vets, standing up with vets, working with vets, and helping vets, particularly of these current occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan, reintegrate into the workforce?
Well, one, on behalf of the 500,000 proud men and women that we represent, I want to thank all the veterans that are listening, and thank them for their dedication and their courage to protect in this country. Two, Tom, we have a program called Helmets to Hard Hats. And that is a program whereby, as an apprenticeable construction union, veterans that are coming out of the military can go through the Helmets to Hard Hats program and actually become members of ours and enroll in our apprenticeship program. We feel that they put their lives on the line to protect this country, and the least that we could do is provide them employment career opportunities as they transition out of the military.
That's great. It's absolutely marvelous. Tell us about post-tension in Nevada.
Post-tension is a contractor that we've had a campaign going on for some time out there.
And they're not treating their workers
well.
They're not treating their workers
right.
You're working to unionize the workplace. Is that
we sure are. This is an employer that that continues to thwart its their workers' rights to form and join a union. This is just a bad bunch that don't treat their workers with respect, don't pay them the kind of wages that they should be paid and the kind of benefits that they deserve.
Yeah. It's time for us to put the labor back in the Department of Labor and roll back Taft-Hartley. We need to re-empower the labor movement in the United States. You guys are doing a great job, though, just taking it on by yourself. I tip my hat to you.
Thank you, Tom.
Terry O'Sullivan, the General President of the Laborers International Union of North America, LIUNA, LIUNA.org, the website. Thanks, Terry, for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
27 minutes past the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-303-2270. Stick around.
Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
I was raised on God and country, and here I take my stand. You and I are we the people. We're the law in this here land. Stand by JFK against the covert plan. I know that secrecy is un-American. They can take their oligarchy with them down to hell. I'll keep the Constitution and that old liberty bell.
35 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Florindo in New York City, thanks for calling. You're on the air. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for getting me on here. I love your show, and I wanted to let you know how much it reminds me of Al Gore's thesis in his new book out there. Inconvenient Truth, but the other one, the Assault on Reason.
The Assault on, yeah.
Restoring the marketplace of ideas in a democracy, which is not what we have in the...
Which seems like a good plan, but please don't compare me to Al Gore when he's being boring.
Okay, well, let me slide on that so I can give you this idea I got from Cass Sunstein.
Yeah, who is an absolutely brilliant writer. Cass Sunstein's book on Roosevelt's the Second New Deal is...
The second Bill of Rights.
Yeah,
he talks about in reference to the caller or the debate you had earlier with another one of your exciting colleagues or in the radio profession there, whoever the guy was who was talking about supply side this and that.
Yeah, I think that was actually just a caller.
Oh, it was just a caller. Him,
yeah.
Okay, it sounded like he sounded really good.
yeah. Well, he was a very well-informed caller, and he was absolutely going right down the line on all the supply side talking points, and probably most progressive talk show hosts even would kind of fall apart and fold in the face of it.
But not Tom.
Well, not to pat myself on the back, but I mean, there are some areas that I know something about. There are the other areas that where I'm a complete idiot.
Well, you're very
this
modest,
is not one of them.
And that's we all know you're modest. But anyway,
but in any case.
Quickly, it's one thing is. Liberty with is that in the Constitution, according to Sunstein, is something that we agree to have in a social organization,
right.
Which requires the protection by law of for the people against disease, disaster, and et cetera, et cetera. So that's there couldn't be any private property without government. So these guys who are laissez-faire, small government, are really missing the point.
Right, and the reason for that is because if I say this is my private property and you say that's my private property, there has to be somebody larger than the two of us arbitrating our dispute.
Otherwise,
and that's,
it's the state of nature. And
that's right.
No progress.
That's right. Yeah, to quote Hobbes, and thus we have to have government. And you're absolutely right. And the conservative worldview is that freedom, and Bush likes to use that word instead of democracy,
uh-huh.
is that freedom is freedom from government.
Right.
And that all wealth is privately owned, and that essentially the only purpose for government is to defend our collective wealth, or our individual wealth, rather, with armies and police. And the liberal worldview is that you can't have freedom until basic necessities are taken care of.
Right.
As Roosevelt said in his acceptance speech in 1936 in Philadelphia, and I think it was July 27, 1936, for his second nomination, he said, an old judge once said, a necessitous man is not a free man. You're not free if you're hungry. You're not free if you're homeless. You're not free if you're at risk of being hungry or homeless within days or weeks or even months if you lose your job.
Right, and unless we have the freedom from fear and want, then we're not really secure in any of our other freedoms.
Amen.
Anyway, thank you for all you do and for getting me on today, and I love your show.
Thank you. Thank you, Florinda. Good to hear from you, and thanks for listening there on WWRL. Kent in Bellingham, Washington, listening on Talk 1090. Hey, Kent.
Yeah, good morning, Tom. At least it's morning here.
Okay.
Hey, I would like to, if I may, address the person you had on right at the beginning of the show who was discussing how environmentalists are supposedly to blame for our fire events these days. Anyway, I wanted to go back to, naturally, this is no surprise, the beginning of the Reagan administration and what happened with our national forests and the ways in which we, as a country, especially the Forest Service, managed those lands. And it was very much a case of corporations coming in and getting to take advantage of the public and the public lands and profit greatly from them and leaving the mess to the public and a Forest Service that wasn't funded to deal with that mess. So I wanted to put that out there as the idea that this is somehow environmentalist fault. This is the fire events we're having now have been talked about by environmental leaders and groups and fire ecologists and different scientists for a long time.
Absolutely. So, and the fact that the fire season has expanded by 2 months over the last 50 years and that the runoff from the mountains is decreasing, which is the water supply and, you know, which keeps the soil moist and the trees and everything, you know, it's just the whole thing. I mean, it's the global warming component of this is clearly at least 2/3 of it. And at least according to the scientists, and I'm inclined to believe them over the politicians. Kent, excellent point. Thank you for making it. I appreciate it. And speaking of Ronald Reagan, let me just give you a little background here. Reagan was once a Democrat. And I, first of all, a tip of the hat to Carl Wolfson, who does the morning show on KPOJ, for finding and sharing this clip with me. Carl is just one of the best guys in progressive talk radio, and I'm honored to be on with him every morning. And this is just the coolest thing I'm going to share with you in just a second here. Ronald Reagan was once a Democrat. And then he divorced his first wife, and he married Nancy Davis. And Nancy Davis's father was a very wealthy conservative Republican. And he sat Ronnie down and essentially said, Ronnie, this is how, let me tell you how the world works. It was sort of like the meeting that Bill Clinton had after he was elected and 2 weeks before he was inaugurated, when Robert Rubin and Alan Greenspan sat him down and said, Bill, we know that you ran as a progressive and as a populist, but you're not going to govern that way because let us tell you how the world works. And similarly, Nancy Davis's father had a talk with Ronald Reagan, and Reagan flipped from being a fairly progressive Democrat to being a Republican. In 1946, in the election of 46, the Republicans took the House of Representatives and the Senate from the Democrats. Now, Roosevelt was still president. And in 47, you know, actually Roosevelt was dead. And Harry Truman was president, as I recall. And Truman in 47 put forward legislation to have a national single-payer health care system. The Republicans shot it down. And the Republicans put through the Taft-Hartley bill, which cut back on union protections, and Truman vetoed it, and they overrode his veto. So here's Reagan calling for Truman in 48 to be reelected, and it's a speech he gave in Minnesota, and he's also calling for the mayor of Minnesota, Hubert Humphrey, to be elected. So with that backstory, listen to Ronald Reagan in 1948.
The profits of corporations have doubled, while workers' wages have increased by only one quarter. In other words, profits have gone up four times as much as wages. And the small increase workers did receive was more than eaten up by rising prices, which have also bored into their savings. For example, here's an Associated Press dispatch I read the other day about Smith L. Carpenter.
Now Reagan is going to do what he brilliantly did, and this is the mark of a brilliant communicator. He's going to tell a personal story to illustrate the didactic example.
A craftsman in Union Springs, New York. Seems that Mr. Carpenter retired some years ago, thinking he had enough money saved up so that he could live out his last years without having to worry. But he didn't figure on this Republican inflation, which ate up all his savings, and so he's gone back to work. The reason this is news is Mr. Carpenter is 91 years old. Now, take as a contrast the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, which reported a net profit of $210 million after taxes for the first half of 1948, an increase of 70% in 1 year. In other words, high prices have not been caused by higher wages, but by bigger and bigger profits.
Now, that's the exact opposite of what Reagan said as president, you know, in the post-Davis era. But he got it back then, and he was speaking the truth. It's amazing. It's just amazing. He continues.
The Republican promises sounded pretty good in 1946. But what has happened since then, since the 80th Congress took over? Prices have climbed to the highest level in history, although the death of the OPA was supposed to bring prices down through, quote, the natural process of free competition, unquote. Labor has been handcuffed by the vicious Taft-Hartley law. Social Security benefits have been snatched away from almost a million workers by the Gearhart bill. Fair employment practices, which had worked so well during wartime, have been abandoned. Veterans' pleas for low-cost homes have been ignored, and many people are still living in made-over chicken coops and garages. Tax reduction bills have been passed to benefit the higher income brackets alone. The average worker saved only $1.73 a week. In the false name of economy, millions of children have been deprived of milk once provided through the federal school lunch program. This was the payoff of the Republicans' promises. And this is why we must have new faces in the Congress of the United States, Democratic faces. This is why we must elect not only President Truman, but also men like Mayor Hubert Humphrey of Minneapolis, the Democratic candidate for senator from Minnesota.
Isn't that incredible? That's Ronald Reagan. And, I mean, just speaking the truth, just laying it out back in 1948, before Nancy Davis's father sat him down and said, Ronnie, you and I have some talking to do. Incredible. When there's big money on the table, somehow opinions change. 45 minutes past the hour.
Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
We debate about health care, welfare, warfare, child care, violence and crime, guns and drugs and secondhand smoke and daylight savings time, education, term limitation, where to cut and who to tax. Children just keep on falling. Falling through the cracks. I know there are those public servants who forgot who's serving who. Now's the time we need to let them know our interests are special too. But the family is the heart and soul of each and every nation. And we the people are the sculptors of the coming generations. If not us, who will do it? If not now, tell me when. We will make this world a better place to raise our children in. There is compassion, love, courage, concern, hope, and a giving spirit, and a voice for change that echoes still. And if we listen, we can hear it.
Now's the time for us to get out there, to get active, to get involved. Show up, my friends. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. George in Tarzana, California. Hey, George, what's on your mind today?
Well, you know, that caller with the trickle-down theory that called in, here's the economics 101. If the consumer doesn't have any money, he's not going to spend it. Does that make sense?
Yep. That's the bottom line, George. Very well said. Thank you very much. Russ in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Hey, Russ, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Just wanted to call and thank you for your show last Thursday.
Our 9/11 special?
On.
Sure, you're welcome.
But I did want to make a comment related to one of the callers he had later. I think her name was Lisa from South Carolina. And she mentioned looking at the physical evidence, drawing your conclusions from that evidence in particular, because when you look at it, when you look at the buildings, they're gone. And when you look at the debris pile immediately after the buildings fell, there was nothing left.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a website where a person is actually doing that. That website is drjudywood.com.
Okay.
And
how can you do that when most of that debris was either buried or shipped off to South Korea or China to be melted down and recycled?
Here's the problem with that. She has pictures of the sub-basements, and they're by and large empty.
Mm-hmm.
There's a PATH train that went underneath the World Trade Center.
Right.
There was an individual PATH train that was actually pulled out of the rubble pile, and it was not damaged at all.
Hmm. Interesting. Interesting.
One other point to make. If a researcher's, you know, going to put their neck out like this, they're actually going to go out and actually sue those entities that are foisting this on us. And this researcher actually has.
No, Russ, I think it's absolutely great. And there's a lot of researchers. There's a zillion of them out there doing the work, and that's what it's going to take. Just like it did with the Kennedy assassination. The Booth examination is still going on. Thanks for the call. Larry in Salem, Oregon. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on a previous caller said that you couldn't have a property without government. But the neocons who have not admitted to being wrong about anything else believe that you can have a property and you get it by either Smith & Wesson or Blackwater.
Yeah. Yeah, good point, and definitely not the way that we need to be acquiring property here or anywhere else in the world. Steve in Eagle Creek, Oregon. Hey, Steve.
Hey, good morning, Tom. Instead of my usual rant about peak oil, I've got something else to give you a heads up about.
Mm-hmm.
There's a change in the accounting standards that's supposed to be going into effect this week that's going to require an awful lot of mark instead to model, mark to market, meaning that the banks are going to have to by the new accounting standards, judge a lot of those mortgage-backed securities and collateralized debt obligations to what the market requires. So now I don't know if they're going to do a lot of song and dance.
And the market is crashing around their heads.
Yeah. And it's because of these new standards that are set to go in this week, we may see some very, very strange things happening this week.
Okay.
But, you put this on top of peak and a bunch of other things, and I don't know, that put in a bigger garden, plant some more fruit trees, and keep your head down.
There you go. Well said, Steve. Thanks a lot for the heads up. I'll keep my eyes open on that. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Hi, Tom. Two observations, one from Theodore Roosevelt, the other one mine. Theodore Roosevelt said this, and I believe it's true today. It's the politician who says what the people are thinking the most and speaks it in the loudest voice. And secondly, I believe we've created a culture that money trumps principle and priorities instead of the other way around.
Yeah, well said, Gary. Very well said. As always, a great pithy comment. Thank you. Chris in Columbus, Ohio. Just a few seconds here, Chris, before we've got to wrap up the show.
Great. I just want to know real quick. You had mentioned a month or so ago about an 1840 or so Supreme Court decision that made it possible for corporations to exist for more than 40 years, and I was just wondering where I could get some more information on that.
Sure. It's actually, the case was in 1886. It was called Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad. I wrote an entire book about it called Unequal Protection. If you go over to my website, tomhartman.com, and click on the corporate power link or corporate dominance link, you'll find an entire website that we built out around that book, including several chapters of it online, and just a whole pile of information dating back to that decision and what's happened as a consequence of that decision all the way to today. So hope that helps you out, Chris. Good luck, and thanks a lot for the call. Coming up tomorrow, Michael Schuller and I will be debating the benefits of the alternative minimum tax. No, it's not as boring as it sounds. It's a big deal. Cliff Stafford Smith is here on Guantanamo Bay. Pete Siegel about his book, The Very Naughty Things, the Book of Vice. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.